Welcome to the Profitable Steward Podcast with Jared Sorensen. In this series, we'll learn and explore regenerative agriculture principles. Through practices that improve soil health, animal health, and good stewardship, we are working to help you increase your productivity and profitability. Join us in learning from successful farm and ranch experts who share stories of growth from their fields to help your fields grow strong. Here is your host, Jared Sorensen.
Curiosity creates clarity. I went with this title because when we are managing these complex agroecosystems, these landscapes, there's so many moving factors. There's so many different parts and between the land, the soil, wildlife dynamics, people, finances. There's so much complexity. And so what I've found in my travels and my journeys is the people who have the most curiosity to dig a little bit deeper and find out really what's going on, those are the people that have the clarity and are making the biggest leaps as far as regenerative agriculture goes. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of background on who I am, how I've come along in my journey, and then we're going to talk about a case study that's fairly prominent from the Cottonwood Ranch in Northeast Nevada. And we're lucky to have A.G. Smith here with us as well. He and I can kind of bounce off of each other as we go through that. So my roots, I'm from Southern Alberta, grew up on a sort of a mixed farm near the Montana border. And my family, they, you know, like I said, it was a mixed farm, conventional cropping. I always loved growing up on the farm, so much freedom, so much room to explore. I was never drawn to the cropping side of things. Something about it just didn't connect with me. And I had, our farm was situated, as you can see here, where the blue pin is. And it was at the base of a vast expanse of native grasslands that stretched to the west, basically all the way to the Rocky Mountains, where Glacier Park sits in Montana. And this photo here, I was maybe about 8 or 9 years old, and this was one of these days that transformed my life forever, where my mom, she would take us up onto this big expanse of grassland. And, you know, you get up there and crest this valley overlooking the Milk River. You can see the Rocky Mountains in the distance. And it was a feeling that I've never experienced before. It was a feeling of connection with something that, you know, I couldn't really explain as a 9-year-old, of course, but you know, you look out and you could see 50 miles out into the distance without a single human structure, maybe just a fence. You've got pronghorn antelope, you've got elk roaming, mule deer. And this moment sort of stuck with me as my years went on. My family sold the farm when I was about 12 years old. We moved away and that really devastated me. But there was something just tugging at me the whole time I moved through my teenage years. I was pulled back to the land in my early 20s. So I'm 34 now for some context. In my early 20s, I decided, man, there's something about getting back on the land and working on a ranch that I just couldn't resist. And so I went to work for this pretty big outfit right on the Alberta-Montana border. These are the Sweetgrass Hills here in the distance, which are right on the border. And I really went to work cutting my teeth, getting back into ranching and agriculture. And through that process, I knew I discovered something. I mean, this was just, I knew I was born to do this type of work and, you know, especially grazing animals. And through this process of working with these large herds of cattle and really getting to know how to manage them on a big scale, I was drawn to bison. I was drawn to the animal themselves and why do they not exist anymore on a large scale? Like I knew they weren't extinct, that you see them around here and there. They're in parks. Some people have them on farms and ranches, but I kept following this curiosity of, you know, why don't we have more? And nobody really had a satisfactory answer for me. So I kept following that and found a position on a ranch here in Southern Alberta that I was really able to gain this experience working with bison and really unique setting on a fairly large scale on about 12,000 acres and a few hundred head of bison. And from that, I was able to start a meat business and, really just continue to dive deeper and deeper. And in that process, I knew as somebody getting back into agriculture, I would maybe be fourth generation, but essentially I'm starting over. So how do I go about this? I mean, I need to figure some things out here and think outside the box to make this work. So I very quickly in 2015 discovered holistic management, and that really opened up a whole new world for me. And so holistic management made a huge impact on me, and I continue to follow that down deeper and deeper and immerse myself, taking courses from people like Roland Kruse and Kirk Gadzia and some of these experienced educators in holistic management. And through that journey, I went through the process of being fixated on these animals as, these amazing creatures that they are. But then along the line, perspective shifts, and I realized, oh, okay, well, it's actually about the grass. And I kept following that a little bit further until one day I went to a workshop in June of 2017 by this woman, Nicole Masters from New Zealand. And I walked into this room, not I was th thinking I knew something about managing land and managing grass and that type of thing. And this woman is standing at the front of this room in a room full of cowboys and cowgirls with the most confidence I've ever seen in my life, and starts talking about how soil is truly alive. And that moment, it was like a punch in the gut, because before that, I didn't really fully grasp that soil was a living, breathing organism. I knew that, yeah, there's earthworms, there's some bugs crawling around in the soil, but that moment really struck me so hard. And for anybody who's been to a Nicole Masters workshop, she's famous for having soil pits where you go out and you dig a big pit and you look at all the different layers of the soil. And so we did that. We went out in the field and did the whole soil pit thing, and it completely blew my mind. And it was a 2-day workshop. That was just the first day. And I'm embarrassed to say it now, but that second day, I was so overwhelmed with what I learned that first day that I just left. I went up into the mountains and camped by myself to try to process what it was that I just learned. So those were some life-changing moments for me on my journey. And during that time, my wife and I, we had the chance to go and move to Texas to manage a bison ranch down there. And that was an excellent experience to learn how to manage in a different ecosystem, a totally different climate, much hotter than we're used to up here in the Northern Plains. And we had Nicole come and consult with us during that time, and she did a workshop, and we really got to know her then. And she kept talking about this program she was developing about essentially a master's degree in regenerative ag or agroecology. And I said, hey, when you get this sorted out, let me know. I'm in. And so a couple of years later, 2021, we had just moved back to Alberta, and Nicole calls me up and said, hey, we've got this CREATE program started. Do you want to join? And I was the I believe I was the first one to sign up. I said, I am completely in. This is what I know I want to do with my life. So I joined the first cohort of the CREATE program, which stands for Consciously Regenerating Ecosystems in Agriculture Through Transformative Experiences. Really, there's no program like it in the world. It's really developed for people who are serious about becoming a professional in regenerative ag in some way. We have people who are primary producers, people who are more on the consulting agronomy side, and sort of anyone in between. We've got a diverse group of people who have taken the course all the way from turf management, cropping, vineyards, small scale gardening to large scale rangeland. And so I think the diversity of the people who we have in our cohort is what makes it special. We've done three create programs. And so after I graduated from the first one, Nicole asked me to join her team as a coach or a teacher on the subsequent create programs. The second create, we hosted the first week of that at Cottonwood Ranch, which is where I got to know AG. And we are currently in the middle of our third create program, based out of the UK, working with students from all across Europe. We have a student in Africa and Australia. And so it's quite widespread and very interesting. And so our network in Integrity Soils, we take a global perspective of land regeneration. Of course, Nicole comes from New Zealand, and now lives in Montana. So we're fairly North American centric, but like I said, we're working in the UK and in Europe and Africa. In a lot of different places, which really has opened my eyes to how people do agriculture across the world, how different it can be, but how similar it is, and how the principles apply no matter where you are. So, what do I do as a regenerative coach? Sort of grazing consulting. Rangelands are my passion and sort of, I guess, my specialty. So, we do soil monitoring, we do baseline monitoring to identify, where are we at in our soils, and really start to build this picture around where do we want to go, where do we want to take these landscapes, and how we can, start to manage for more resilient, profitable ecosystems. I'm also really into the land design and the infrastructure piece, specifically around grazing. And with my bison background, I love to work with new and existing bison producers. Nicole and I just recently re released a grazing course, an online grazing course, focused on how to graze for microbiology. And we really built the course that I wish I had back in 2017 when I was totally overwhelmed with, learning that soil is alive. And so we just came out with this in December. It's fully online. You work at it at your own pace. And so if you go to integritysoils.com, you can find the Grazing for Life course and use the discount code AGSTEWARD20 for 20% off of that. Some other landscapes that we are working on, some different properties. This is the Durham Bison Ranch in Wyoming, south of Gillette, Wyoming. I work alongside my associate here, Roland Cruz, who I was a former holistic management student of, and he's brought me in. Roland has been working with these guys for over 30 years, working on holistic management and improving management and range monitoring. They've seen some major successes over that time, increasing plant cover, reducing bare ground, increasing production, and some of those things. But they are looking to go beyond that and start to look at their soil and see, really what might be happening underground that could be influencing, maybe a plateau in management. And so it's been really cool to work with John Flocini and these guys at the Durham Ranch. Big place, 55,000 acres, 25 head of bison, 90 paddocks. Quite impressive to see this herd move through that ranch. Another place we were on this summer, the Laurel Leaf Ranch, also Brock Livestock Company out of Casey, Wyoming. They're along the North Fork of the Powder River. Another fairly big place. They sold their cows a few years ago and started moving towards large mobs of yearlings that they put together and graze seasonally, daily, multiple times a day, moves at pretty high stock densities, and they are seeing some rapid change on their land, especially some of this flood irrigated ground along the Powder River. So keep an eye out for these guys. I'm sure they'll be hosting workshops and they really want us, share what they're doing and get the word out there. This is an interesting one. We hosted the first week of Create at the Allthorpe Estate in Northampton, UK. And this is owned by the Spencer family, who I claim that I'm related to, but I don't think they've been on that one. But this is Princess Diana's brother, Charles, who owns this estate. And they got onto Nicole's work through her book, For the Love of Soil, and really realized that across this 14,000 acres, which some of it's managed themselves and some they lease out to tenant farmers that they really were going down a bad path with all the conventional tillage and chemical treadmill that they're on. And so they're looking to transition the whole estate to regenerative agriculture in the next couple of years. So pretty cool to see what they're doing. The UK, I mean, so much opportunity in agriculture over there, mainly to do with their climate. I was talking to AG on the phone yesterday and said, if they don't get rain for about 3 weeks, they're in sort of a major drought crisis. And so, it rains consistently throughout the year, and as you can see, they're able to grow some grass. And of course, here, southwest Alberta, we're along the Rocky Mountains, just north of Glacier Park. Do a lot of work here with grasslands, farms, and ranches. And over on the right, you can see this innovative carbon farming system called bioactive emissions farming that I am following and involved in, where you take the exhaust from the tractor and cool it through this fusion tank in the center, and it creates this carbon microbial brew. These two side tanks inoculate that carbon with biology, and that is forced back out through the seed drill. Through this can be set up on a sprayer, really anything, and it is vaped onto the soil. It's remarkable, the results of this. This is now 20 some years in the making in the sixth generation. Conventional farms are able to go cold turkey off of fertilizers and with no reduction in yield, increased plant health, and increases of soil organic matter on average of 0.5% per year. So pretty incredible stuff. So the way we operate is with a collaborative mindset. We are not the experts. I am not an expert. We do not have all the answers, and nobody has all the answers, but we strive to ask the right questions. So really digging deep and again, getting curious as to what's going on the land, and curious as to what it is we truly want, and how do we want our life and our land to look, and move in that direction. And so back to this piece about curiosity creates clarity. And AG is a perfect example of that. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more here. So a framework that we use, Nicole developed, called the 5 M's framework. And essentially, mindset encapsulates everything that we're doing and we're managing on the land. And so mindset encapsulates, of course, our management decisions and how those management decisions influence organic matter, carbon, minerals, and microbes. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at a case study from Cottonwood Ranch, Northeast Nevada, of, I suppose, what's becoming a fairly famous case study of how they were able to take some very degraded land and sort of transform it through curiosity. So you can see AG here. This is when he took us to the top of the Jarbidge Mountains. He's pointing off in the distance, probably talking about an elk hunt he was on 30 years ago or something like that. And on the right, you can see the north side, what we call the north side of the Cottonwood Creek at the headquarters, where they've been doing holistic management intensive grazing for about 30 years or so. So we're looking at the Cottonwood Ranch, and you can see here on the left-hand side from 2016, the south side, everything that's pretty brown to the south of the creek is what we call the south side, and I believe it's about 250 acres. And then so on the north side, it's a much smaller portion that they were managing pretty intensively, and the soil health couldn't be more different between those two sites. What you see on the right is the south side in 2023, after they've got pivots installed and moved away from the flood irrigation and have went through a few years of this sort of soil health program that we're going to talk about. So pretty cool to see the contrast between the two. So when looking through the lens of the 5 M's, we start with mindset. And talking with AG, it's interesting. Over the years, They had this sort of mindset with people coming in and trying to figure out what was going on with that land being so compacted and so degraded, not really producing anything. And sort of the conclusion that a lot of people came to was, well, this is just the way it is. It might be the soil type, it might be whatever. Maybe this is all it can produce. And that sort of manifested into, well, that it had been continuously hayed for a very long time. The flood irrigation was problematic as far as being able to manage the water and have water on it at the right time. But essentially, when there was water coming down Cottonwood Creek, it would saturate that field and, it would grow a little bit. But as soon as the water left, there was zero growth and it dried up and basically things got cooked off. And so it sort of over the years manifested into, well, maybe sacrifice area is a little bit harsh, AG, but continuous haying and horse grazing over the years, and nobody had thought to dig a hole and during that time. And so finally, as AG is a curious person, he kept trying to get to the bottom of this, and he met Nicole, maybe 6 years ago or something, and said, "Hey, would you mind coming out and trying to help us figure out what's going on here?" And so, being the humble guy that he is, he was able to ask for help, which is sometimes all we need to do to get things moving. So looking at the organic matter on that field, you'll see pictures of it coming up here. The organic matter, I mean, carbon and organic matter is one of the most important metrics that we look at on a landscape. If we are deficient in carbon and organic matter, then our soil is likely to be totally dysfunctional and not resilient and not able to produce much. We've lost a lot of organic matter, especially on agricultural land that's been tilled and farmed for a long time or overgrazed for a long time, which is a lot of our agricultural land across the world. On this field on the south side, the organic matter wasn't horrible. It was a little less than 3%, but it was existing in this non-functional thatch layer that essentially wouldn't allow water to actually penetrate it, and it wasn't available for plants and microbes to use. It had a lack of humus, so it had some organic matter, but humus, which is the more stable form of carbon and organic matter, which, contrary to popular belief or some narratives out there, a lot of people believe that organic matter is the result of sort of plant material being trampled back in or incorporated back into the soil. But most of our stable organic matter is built up through plant photosynthesis, pumping sugars into the soil, having microbes consume those sugars, and then dying and turning over and being eaten by others in the soil food web and pooped out. And increasingly, you get this buildup of microbial necromass, dead microbes that form stable humus. So I'm missing some text here, but this is the north side of Cottonwood, where they have been grazing intensively, management intensive grazing for about 30 years. Carbon is much higher. I wasn't AG, I was looking at some soil tests that you sent me, and I believe that the most recent test showed that this is about 8.7% organic matter. Does that sound right to
Yeah,
you?
that's yeah the what they did last fall.
Okay.
That's sort of.
And so that checks out. I mean, it's a deep, dark, rich color all the way down through the soil profile. Another piece about this is there was seven times the humus in these samples, which humus has about 10x water holding capacity to just like non-humic forms of organic matter. And so the water holding capacity of these pastures were about 700 times of the south side. Oh, so here's my so 1 minute in 1 minute it took in 2 inches of water. Nearly 95% plus palatable grass species. And oh, so this is 70 times more water holding capacity than the south side. So here is the south side, and the south side is really interesting. You could see this thatch layer that sits on top. Most of the species up here are wiregrass. There's some sedges that were pretty unpalatable. And AG said there was a species of bluegrass that was in there that was sort of palatable, but over time that kind of got grazed out. Before Nicole, they had never dug a hole on this. And so when they got out there, AG loves to use his backhoe. So he got his backhoe out there and started digging. And about 3 feet down, well, you can see where the roots end, about 3-4 inches down. And this layer, I mean, there's some roots in there, but not much of more or less subsoil. And then basically, I don't want to call it a river, but there was a whole bunch of water sitting about 2-3 feet down below that soil surface that those plants were unable to access. And this came as quite a surprise to these guys. You can see these cowpies sitting on top of the soil, not cycling in. Biology is just not functioning. And I just want to go back. It took 24 minutes for 1 inch of water to infiltrate, which, I mean, after, say, 12 minutes, you know your water cycle is pretty broken. So through the 5 M's, we look at minerals. And when we look at rangeland, we work a lot on rangeland. Addressing mineral deficiencies is sometimes really difficult and completely uneconomical. But if you're working with some more higher production ground, irrigated ground, then you have a lot more leverage. So in the case of the south side, there was a major, major calcium deficiency. You don't quite have the numbers, but it was very low. Calcium's one of the most important, potentially more important than nitrogen in terms of foundation for a soil health program. So over time, what seems to have happened is the calcium had been leached out because of all that flood irrigation and just lack of structure and lack of function. And so when we have calcium in the right balance, we have good soil structure. So we're able to build soil aggregates, which a part of that is mycorrhizal fungi development. Fungi need calcium to be able to develop and build those aggregates, which are pores that hold on to water and nutrients and allow roots to move through the profile. Calcium is critical to plant cell division and wall development. So think them being able to grow and maintain a strong, rugged structure. And I mean, I could keep going on and on about the importance of calcium, but it was pretty dire in that situation. Microbially speaking, the south side was very low in active bacteria and fungi, very, very low in fungi. And we look at a rate, we look at the total fungal to bacteria ratio. It was about 0.57 to 1. And this will really depend on the lab that you're using, what will spit out as a total fungal to bacteria ratio. So if you're doing soil testing, make sure you try to get an understanding from the lab that you choose to use and what, you know, how they come up with that fungal to bacteria ratio, because it can be quite skewed. I know in PLFA tests, to have a 0.5 to 1 fungal to bacteria ratio is actually pretty good. So there's a lot of different approaches to this, but what they found on the north side, which is not really surprising, is 10 times the active fungi, 3 times total, more bacteria, which bacteria are essential. They're good for our system, but if they're out of balance, it's a problem. And so what they're seeing was this 1.75 to 1, so more fungi to bacterial biomass. And the more generally speaking, there might be a certain point where this is a point of diminishing return, but generally the more we can push our fungal to bacteria ratio up, the better it is for our pasture growth. And so as we look up the soil food web, we're looking at protists. So we're looking at protozoa, nematodes, and these are our larger predators in the soil food web. So these guys basically swim through the soil profile, eating bacteria. So as they're eating the bacteria, they're pooping them out the other side and create this pool of plant available nitrogen. So you see this end potential here in relation to, you know, how active those soil predators are. You know, much higher, of course, in the north side. We also look at the root feeding nematodes, so that, you know, higher sort of parasitic nematodes in the south side versus the north side. An important piece to look at with the protists is that they need a water film in the soil to be able to swim around and hunt and graze on bacteria. So if we're, you know, if our soil is drought stricken, it's not resilient, we don't have structure, we're not, you know, we don't have water holding capacity, then we have a diminished ability for these protists to do their work and provide nitrogen to the plant. Plant health was, of course, lower as well. You know, outside of the palatability of the species, the palatability of the plants was much lower. Protein was much lower. All the nutrients across the board were quite a bit lower on that south side. And so what did they do? You know, AG can help speak to this, but essentially starting in 2018, I believe, they started to trial this soil health program with vermicast, fish hydrolysate, molasses, humic acid. Didn't really work. It didn't really work because there were, you know, all sorts of issues with water and drought and other things going on. And AG, do I have it right where you went about this program prior to ripping?
Yeah, prior to ripping, but also prior to having control of the water before the pivots. So it was still flood irrigated. So, and really, you know, yeah, it was prior to all of that. So it was, I'm not sure there was totally a loss, but we learned a lot. It was really a learning experience to begin, for a beginning start.
And so in 2019, they took a ripper through and ripped that ground because, I mean, there's a certain point on in some situations where, you know, we don't generally like to look at tillage or some sort of major disturbance, but that ground needed a bit of a reset. And so they came through and they ripped it with it was an implement with shanks. Is that correct, AG?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just, yeah, a big, had big shanks.
Why don't you describe how that went through there and what, you know, what came up as a result?
Okay, so there was a couple, you know, early on when I was out aerating this ground, we were trying all sorts of things to see if we could improve the production on it. And when I'd get to the end of my swath that I was going down, and I'd turn that tractor, and it was one of those big aerators, and it when I'd turn, the whole 4 inches or so of that thatch just rotated, it just moved like a rug on a hardwood floor. And when that happened, I'm going, wow, this certainly shouldn't be, I don't think, doing this. So, but that 4 inches of thatch was so, so thick and such a barrier, to put any, there's no way, we tried to seed into it and through the years. And anyway, there's just nothing would take. So we figured we had to rip that thatch. We had to rip that up. So we hired it done. He brought this big tractor out, and he had all these tongs on the back, this ripper, and he dropped, it was a big tractor, and he dropped it into the ground thinking that this is the normal rate that he ran it, and it killed the tractor. He said he'd never ripped soil that was that tough. It was just incredibly compacted. And so when they finally got done, they ripped it in a couple of directions. You ended up with like bricks. There was like these 4x6 and different sizes, but they were like bricks. The whole field was just a mangle of these, and you'd break your ankle walking out across it. And we were going, how in the hell are we going? And we couldn't really break it up any further than that, unless we'd have taken a disc and disced it. And we didn't want to, or couldn't really afford to do all of that. So we were wondering how it was going to work to seed it. And the guys that we hired, they had access to this big Belgian cedar. It was made in Belgium, and this thing came out and it was huge. It was like when they unloaded it, it was all in sort of a knot thing to haul. And then they started pushing buttons or levers, and this thing just started opening up like a butterfly or whatever. And they said this cedar will work, will do that. It had a big roller on it that sort of rolled the soil and made a bed for it, and then it seeded it, and then it had rollers behind it, and by golly, it worked. Anyway.
And so that same year, I believe you were able to get the pivots installed.
Oh, okay. So yeah, we actually had the pivots were being installed that same year. Yes, we ripped it and we installed the pivots in the same year. And then we came in with it was an NRCS program, so they wanted us to do some perennial plants. So we did some perennial grasses, but we also did cover crops with it. And that year we did radishes and oats, and there was one other one anyway. And so they came up good. It really seeded well, and that things really popped up. And those radishes, by the time they were done, there was lots of them were the size of a football in that soil. I didn't know radishes did that, but anyway. So, and that itself broke helped, and they were a rad. They were specifically to help break soil up, the way they grow. And so they did their thing, and then added organic, then brought it into the ground and added organics. So, so anyway, that was the beginning. Everything came up really well, but the soil was still, I mean, still missing all those things. We put calcium on it, and we were trying to put as many inputs on it that we could afford. And but those they all jumped up a little bit. Those radishes did the best of all of them, but they all jumped up and grew for a little while, and then they didn't grow anymore, and a lot of weeds, not noxious weeds, but weeds came into it. And so the first 2 years, that sort of was the that was the MO. It would, because the soil still was so poor, that the seeding would be good, but it wouldn't really produce much. And we put cows on it and we grazed it, but it didn't hold them for very long. And then the third year into it, things really started changing. We'd been putting calcium on it. We've been putting an encapsulated slow nitrogen, that not just typical nitrogen you put on, but this was stuff that Nicole recommended, and some other things that the soil needed. And third year in, all of a sudden we went and we added, and we the part of that cover crop on the third year was triticale, and I think collard greens, and anyway, I had a variety of things, but production really, all of a sudden production was, it started the third year. And it went from, typically that south side would put up 3/4 of a ton to the acre when we back when we were haying it. We quit haying it quite a few years ago just because it just wasn't really worth running the equipment over. And so we were grazing it, and we had quite a bit of wire grass in it. And it, when we'd hay it, it was probably 25% wire grass. But one of the things that happened after we started grazing it more is the animals would graze the good grasses and just leave the wire grass. And so through probably 10 years, the wire grass went from 25% of that side to 75%. The wire grass was just expanding exponentially. And so so it was getting to be less and less valuable for grazing even. So, and again, that's back to where we had lots of people said, well, maybe this just is what it's going to be. But when that third year we got, we went from that 3/4 ton to the acre historically to about 1.5 tons to the acre off that, off those two pivots. And then this last year, we're still putting more calcium and more inputs and things on it. And it's still not where we want it to be yet. But this last year, one of the pivots produced 1 1/3 tons to the acre, and the other pivot was 3 tons to the acre. We've never put up 3 tons to the acre in anything out here.
I think, AG, the photo I took here was of the 2022 crop, the first, you know, real bumper that you had there. This is the west side at the, you know, 3.5 tons per acre.
Yeah, it just, and so it's been amazing. I mean, I wouldn't have thought we could take that soil and do what's happening to it. And it's just getting started. I mean, it's amazing. And we went from when we've been doing monitoring on that site for quite a while, because we're in a credit system for sage grouse. And so we have these permanent sites on the private that we monitor. And prior to Nicole and working with her, we had basically three grasses there. There was the wire grass, then there was a little sedge, and then a bluegrass or something that was pretty palatable. They really liked the little sedge and the bluegrass for grazing and left the wire grass. But this last year when we did it, there was five different, when we did this monitoring, there's five different perennial grasses in there now, and six different legumes that and it's all been seeded and planted in there, but they've taken, and I mean, it's just amazing, the variety. Before there was no wild, I mean, when we flood irrigated it, you'd get a lot of water birds and things because the water was just sitting on that ground. And if those grasses weren't just sitting in water, they wouldn't grow. And I've got pictures of the water of that side, grass sitting in the water sitting on the grass and the grass growing right beside it. The grass is not sitting in water and it's not growing. It just absolutely stopped and drying up. It was so dysfunctional that the sponge effect didn't, I mean, there was no sponge effect or anything to, you know, and through the years, it's interesting. So water, lack of water control and flood irrigating over 100 some years, leached the soil out and caused the problem. But if you took the water, but now we have created plants that absolutely required, the only place they got their nutrients is with the water that was on there. And if you didn't put water on it, you got no production whatsoever. So it was sort of a catch-22. We knew we needed to get control of the water. The minute we tried to control the water, the grass quit growing. So it was, it was a catch-22, and from a wildlife perspective, some antelope would come on the edge and drink out of the irrigation ditches. But this last year, there was two antelope that raised their little ones on the pivot. They had them and raised them on the pivot. Jason jumped a half a dozen or more mule deer out of out of the ground. And when you, after you hay it or graze it, whichever, and we're doing both, the sage grouse that moves into there, just amazing. So we've created, and when we were doing this and getting NRCS help and the credit system people, they were a little leery to have us put pivots on the place to go along with that. And because they were afraid of the raven perching and the depredation to sage grouse. But that's one of the things we're going to try to show is that pivots, this has taken non-wildlife habitat and created great wildlife habitat with the pivots. We'd have never been able to create that without the pivots. So anyway, I've talked a lot now.
Sure. Oh, that's good. I appreciate it. I mean, yeah, it adds a lot more depth to this conversation. And you can see, I mean, this photo on the right, this hole I dug, this plant I dug up, triticale plant, you can see it start to darken up. The roots are going deeper. It's mixing, you know, it's mixing that top organic layer with the subsoil and creating, you know, sort of a darker carbon color throughout the profile. And I believe with the tests you sent me today, I believe if I'm looking at the right one, that the organic matter level is increasing, which is not surprising at all. Yeah. And maybe upwards of 1% from what it was.
I think about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, you can see here that this is me digging that hole this summer when I was out in July, and it just, you know, it's incredible, the stark difference. And it's cool to see, because of the pivot corners, there are areas that are left essentially untouched, and they're a control to compare from what it was to what it is now. And so, you know, it's that comparison is still there. If you want to look up on YouTube, fungal forming case study with the soil food web, Nicole does her own presentation where she looks at this case study a little bit further, and a lot of it's what we've covered today, but she puts her own spin on it, of course. So what can we learn from cottonwood? You know, get curious about what's the root cause. And in this case, it was a couple things. You know, definitely the getting a handle on the water and the water cycle. You know, these major limiting factors, big one being calcium and the lack of fungal development. And how do we work to start to address those major problems? And, you know, that compaction issue. One thing I didn't touch on earlier is that compaction creates bacterially dominated soils, and vice versa. Bacteria excesses and imbalances of bacteria create compaction. So it's this sort of vicious cycle. And, you know, you've got bacterial dominance, you've got no structure, it can't bring in water. And the bacteria are signaling for these sort of low quality annual weeds, or the, you know, the less desirable, less palatable species. It's signaling for those to germinate. And so by sort of, you know, going about that reset, they were able to break that cycle and get some palatable green growing plants that are actually pumping carbon down into the system. Another piece that we can learn is to not get dogmatic about different tools and practices like tillage and ripping and nitrogen fertilizer. You know, in regenerative ag, we can sort of get dogmatic about that. Like, hey, you know, we can never use these things, but everything is a tool. And if applied in the right situation, you know, at the right time, these can all be a part of a good program. And so, you know, it's not like AG and his family are looking to continue to till and fertilize till the end of time. They're using it responsibly. And another piece is never stop learning. If AG would have given up on this 20 years ago, they never would have got back to, you know, or got to where they are now, finding a solution for it. And then maybe my biggest takeaway hanging out with AG is to get rid of the shoes, you know, start walking around in bare feet on the land and feel what's going on. I think it gives you some good insights into what's actually happening on the land.
Well, you probably just took your whole presentation and now it's going, well, they're just a kook out there doing something, wandering around.
And they would be right.
But also, you mention me all the time. This is such a project of family and employees, and there's so many people involved in all of this besides me. I just end up being the one that people talk to a lot because the others don't really want to do this. So, but anyway, this, especially this pivot and this soils and all of that, my daughter Mackenzie and son-in-law Jason, this is their baby. At my age, I'd have never put pivots in and things, but so this is they're going to take this ground and run with it. So
in summary, just a reminder, we have our Grazing for Life course, Grazing for Microbiology on integritysoils.com. You can enter the 20% discount code, AgSteward20. And if anybody wants to get a hold of me, talk to me anymore about anything related to what you've seen today, my email's right here, cody@sweetgrassbison.ca, 403-632-7159. Send me a text, give me a call, whatever. I'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Cody. This was fantastic. And thank you, AG.
Thanks for joining us on the Profitable Steward podcast. Want to learn more about making your enterprise more profitable? Check out AgSteward on our website, www.agsteward.fyi. Here at AgSteward, we're working hard to make sure you have the latest tools and knowledge from the field of regenerative agriculture. Subscribe to our podcast to keep up with the latest info and help us spread the word by giving this video a thumbs up, sharing this information with other farmers, and as always, please join the conversation by leaving us a rating and a review so we can help you to keep growing strong.